Welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves and our icebreaker question. I found a surprising question asked on Twitter. Why are management teams afraid of having a pen test or risk assessment? It didn't even occur to me that management teams would think this is a bad thing to have, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
This is Mike. Three words: shoot the messenger. If the problems aren't there, they don't have to worry about them. And I think, you know, just in general, there's still a lot of misunderstandings about someone who finds a problem versus, you know, who's actively exploiting it.
This is Chris Kaiser. I'm going to go with plausible deniability on this one. A lot of people will say, you know, it's better for us to not know what we don't know than to be aware of it and not do anything or not be able to afford to do something about it. So many times people will just err on the side of, well, if I don't know about it, it's not a problem, which, you know, isn't entirely logical, but it's definitely done.
Hi, this is Killian. I think the answer falls kind of in a spectrum between kind of what Mike and Chris both said. I also think that there's a degree of pride or ego might not be quite the right word, but I would imagine they would set out to have a, you know, good security practice, and they don't necessarily want somebody to come and kind of make them look bad in a way if they find a vulnerability that they didn't know about or that's new. There's career and there's, you know, ego to a certain extent. And it just kind of makes it look bad. Like, hey, you missed this. This is what we're paying you for. Is that the right choice? So it casts a lot of doubt in people's minds, right, wrong, or otherwise. And I think that goes back to the shoot the messenger thing, too.
Can I disagree with all of you guys? In order to become a management and executive person, you need to be an aggressive learner. And I think security folks are very encouraging, and based on the people I interact with, they don't present it in a mean or crude way. It's just, hey, let's just fix this and move on, because there's going to be hundreds of them. You guys could be right, but I'm going to be on their side. Maybe they just don't understand it enough.
The first thought that came into my head when you said that is, I think the technical people in the room, when they get their results, will understand it. But it's the sort of thing that non-technical people might freak out if they see that there's an issue. So regardless of whether or not it's not a huge issue, or if there's, you know, only tiny holes to plug, so to speak, the amount of education that the people who are receiving that message actually have might affect their response to it.
I think you're right, Cindy, to a certain extent. And it would be fantastic if we could address every problem in security. But I think the big problem is, hey, you know, we need to fix this. Well, once you know about it, you do have to fix it, going back to that. But the problem always comes down to budget. There's a finite amount of you know, monetary resources and people and human time. And it's just not possible to fix every problem. So it would be fantastic if we could. But then it goes back to the, you know, what I was saying is like, hey, we gave you all this money last year, last quarter, to deal with these problems. Why do we have this issue? So it's, I think you're right, but I think there's a lot of gray area between.
True. Thanks, guys. So as always, for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card name. So back to our initial icebreaker question, management who are into security and into reducing their risk, there was an employer, they keylogged their software and monitored an employee's activity, and then they fired him for it. They accused him of using work hours to work on his father's project, and a judge in Germany said that it's against the law. And I'm wondering, why would an employer choose to use keylogging versus an audit trail? And does context matter when you're tracking someone's activity? Because it sounds like maybe he wasn't given a chance to explain himself. And then my last question is also in the article too, where they posited, you know, even if it's legal, does it make it ethical? What do you guys think?
You know, maybe we'll leave the legal versus ethical for a moment. But I think, in especially in this scenario, context is key. And in a lot of cases, context is definitely key. Now, if they have an absolute policy, like you're not allowed to do any work or any personal business on your laptop, that's one thing. But taking it to that extreme measure to keylog them, while they, again, might not necessarily be wrong to do that if that's their policy, but I feel like there's probably a better way to handle it that wouldn't get this negative attention. But it also seems, at least kind of from my poking around the industry, that key logging or the screen recording of employees is getting more common. I don't know if anyone else has noticed that as well, but it seems like it's increasing. There's that kind of Big Brother attitude that a lot of people are having for, I'm not sure why.
I can't really talk to, like, I guess the prevalence of it, but one thing that worries me about it is that keyloggers must be pulling in all the passwords that all their people are typing, and must be storing them in plain text. And I just wonder if that's just shooting themselves in the foot. It seems bad to me for it. That's the least of the reasons that it seems bad. But
yeah, I mean, I'm reading this, and the first question that comes to mind is, you know, if they're logging all this stuff, wouldn't they have, you know, timestamps for when the person stopped doing their actual job and started doing the work on the side? I figure that, like, that might be, unless somebody wants to jump in and tell me my knowledge of keyloggers is off, but I feel like that might be pretty straightforward.
Speaking of keylogging and other types of security tools as a way to potentially suss out the bad guys, there's a company now that watches everything you do and predicts what you'll do next in order to stop it. And their clients include the CIA, the FBI, the NSA. I like that they don't have an official office because everything they do is secretive. But the article/book, it's like an excerpt from a book, it compares what they do to Minority Report, starring Tom Cruise. And in the movie, they're able to predict when someone is going to commit a crime before it happens. And the movie came out over 10 years ago, and there's a whole bunch of ethical and moral issues that we were able to skirt around at the time because it wasn't really our reality. And obviously, there are no simple answers. Let's play around this for a little bit and see if we can reimagine what our world would be like in 5 years. Like, do you see philosophical consultants working with IT or business people, or maybe IT pros who will initially be responsible for being the detective, and then something bad will happen, and then lawmakers will try to prevent it from happening again? What are your thoughts?
It's hard for me to separate how much sort of like extra media gloss is on this versus, you know, what you might otherwise just think is, oh, like smart use of statistics. Like, we have this data available about crime. We have this data available about, you know, we're, you know, looking for patterns in crimes, trying to find someone who's doing something horrible. Somehow, if, you know, it's Sherlock Holmes who looks at that and says, like, oh, well, it's the guy every Friday who, when he gets his paycheck, goes and gets a sandwich. And so therefore we'll catch him at, you know, 1 o'clock next Friday. Like, that's great. But if it's, you know, an AI or statistical inference application, that it's suddenly bad. And that's not exactly it, but it's far better to be efficient than inefficient. And it's far better to, you know, go to where crimes are than where there aren't. So I think a lot of this is for the good. And I think a lot of it's just, you know, again, applying good statistics to data.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. I think it's, you know, we're in an era of big data where you can actually crunch the numbers like this and use that for that purpose. My concern here is, I guess it's more of it on the ethical side of things than anything else. If you have a secretive system that basically tells people that you're about to commit a crime and can be justified, can be used to justify arresting someone without, you know, explaining in detail exactly how they got to that conclusion, I feel like that has the rationale for locking somebody up based on something you can't describe or explain in detail means you basically have the people who are in control of that then have carte blanche to do whatever they want without effectively explaining it. That's the part that scares me, is that, you know, oh yeah, the machine told us we should lock you up. Well, can you explain why? Well, it's secretive. Sorry, we can't do that. Well, I feel really uncomfortable about that, you know? It's terrifying.
I mean, Chris, that's a straw man argument. That's not what anyone is saying here, that we're going to lock someone up like Minority Report. It's, you know, much more general than that. But, and that's not to totally discount what you're saying, because I do think there's areas where this does come into play that are more in the civil side of things than on the criminal. They are equally confounding and frustrating. For some reason, like at certain online shops, they don't like my credit card, and other ones, the money spends just fine. And they're like, oh, and you contact them, they're like, oh, well, it's our anti-fraud stuff. And it's wrong. It's not like this is infallible, but I do think there's positive aspects to this being used.
I'll put maybe a little bit more of a point on what Chris says. You have to think about it from a confirmation bias standpoint. If the machine is telling you that, you know, there's criminals in this area, you're going to show up and be like, well, those guys are definitely criminals because they're in this area. It kind of goes back to, it doesn't matter what you know, it's what you can prove. And even taking it back to, you know, the old detective movies or even police in the real world, you have the detectives that get the hunch. Like, I've been around enough criminals and crime scenes to know, to get a feeling of what happened. But you still have to go out there and process the evidence and follow the leads to find the right person. It's not, you know, it's not like Sherlock Holmes where he can, you know, has the superhuman ability to be like, oh, it was this guy because of some, you know, crazy thought exercise, and then just go round them up.
So let's go to reality, back to reality, and talk about a few things that happened recently in the news. There are a bunch of hackers at DEF CON where they were at a voting hacking village and hacked nearly every machine. And the activity was an exercise in demonstrating the need to cultivate a security mindset in Washington and with campaign staffers. What stood out in your mind about this exercise?
To me, and I'll just use kind of Chris's argument from the previous topic, is that a lot of these systems, they try and keep secret. They try and, you know, prevent people from doing this type of analysis on it and code review. They're relying on security by obscurity. And I think this exercise just proved that in the voting system, where public confidence is the foundation and the bedrock of our system, these systems can't be kept secret. They need to be thoroughly vetted and understood to make sure that they're secure. And then we don't have flaws. We're not just relying on, you know, trust me type of logic to protect this data.
One time I saw a guy almost split his face in half with a hatchet because he didn't have a hammer. And so he was using the back of the hatchet to try to like pound a nail.
Wait, seriously?
And yeah, yeah.
And was it blood squirting everywhere?
No, not so bad. But, you know, enough that I was worried, you know, about having to take someone to the hospital. I bring this up because we're trying to draw parallels through this stuff. And to me, this is like the knowing and understanding this and the right tool for the right job. Now, using the back of the hatchet to pound the nail in, that's not the right tool for the right job. You know, we start talking about security and what systems are good for and how they're to be used. I think you need to use the right tool for the right job and to apply the technology in the right ways. And the voting machine stuff just doesn't feel like the right application in most cases.
How so, Mike?
Well, you mentioned private and secret versus open, and I think that's a lot of it. And maybe it's much more that the proprietary systems that are in use versus like an open and certified system and something that's openly auditable would be much better. And in particular, you know, we're talking about voting system. This is something that's, you know, sacred in the democratic process where you're able to go into a booth alone with this machine and make your vote without any interference. And that also means that you have physical access to it with a nice privacy screen for as much time as you need to root the machine and then make your changes. And that's sort of the start of it. It's frustrating. Like, you know, in the article, what they describe these as voting machines as dumb ATMs. And, you know, we have ATMs that, you know, there's other issues with. But it just drives me nuts. I just wish we had paper ballots for voting. Come on.
I had the same thought when I read the article.
two things, Mike. I mean, it sounded like you were dangerously close to agreeing with me there. So we'll think of something before you can disagree with me.
But, well, I've been sick recently. So, you know, I'm still recovering. Probably when the fever breaks, I'll be in better mood and disagree with you better. So.
But if you remember, I mean, Mike, you're probably old enough, and Cindy maybe. I think Chris, you're a little bit younger. But do you remember, like, voting on the old paper ballots or with like the mechanical machines?
Yes.
Actually, yeah.
I
remember mimeographs. I'm that old. I don't know why you keep bringing it up. So,
but I'm just saying, you know, is technology always the answer? I guess. I mean, those systems, they were slower and they were kind of a little bit more cumbersome to manage, but they weren't also susceptible. Sometimes maybe low tech could be an answer.
Well, I wonder if that's even the wrong split, the low tech or high tech, whether it's, you know, auditable and open versus closed and proprietary. And I think this is a case where, you know, open and auditable are features that are missing from these machines. Even if it's properly secured and things, if it's not auditable and open and verifiable, then I think it's as a solution to the problem of easier, faster voting. I think it's real different.
I think I align a little bit more with Killian on this one. When I read this, what actually stood out to me was that it was interesting to see it from a different perspective of, you know, people think about, you know, hacking voting machines would go in and change the votes. But part of what they mentioned was just altering minor details about, like, the voter roll so that the voting process actually slowed down for people. And I thought that was really interesting because even if you can create enough of a backlog there, people will leave, people will not vote, and it'll affect... not necessarily affect the votes that are in the machine, but the process itself and obstruct it in that sense. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. It's a completely different way of approaching an attack to voting machines than I would ever considered.
So this is a little bit of a tangent, but a couple months ago, I was at a conference and heard someone from the Microsoft electronic elections team. And so they have a solutions group within Microsoft that just handles election matters. And so this wasn't, this was more like a back-end service that helped tally reports that were called in. And one of the things he had mentioned was that during the presidential campaign, this is a while back, when Rick Santorum and one of the other people who were in the Iowa caucus, and it, actually Rick Santorum would have won, except someone typed in the wrong number on the phone, the interactive voice system. And so they punched it in, didn't hear the beep, and then punched the number in again. And so instead of like 22 votes, they entered 2,200 votes, and it wasn't caught by the system because it was all just hand tallies. And so they were like, yep, this person actually typed these in. And there was no system to say like, wow, there's 100 times more people voting this year in this one tiny county with six farms in it than there were last year, you know? And so, and again, to me, this is like the right tool for the right job, like making sure weird discrepancies like that don't come in because you're applying statistics well. That's a great use of technology. And maybe in other spots, it's not so great.
Let's talk about how bad guys are using technology. So recently, Europeans and Americans worked together to shut down two of the biggest dark web marketplaces. And now that authorities have figured out how to find these people on Tor, do you think that the bad guys will figure out another place to hide or to do business? Since I think that takedown was supposed to symbolize to the smaller folks that the police will find you no matter what you do. And my guess is that once we all migrate to digital systems, that I feel like the bad guys might do a blend of analog and digital things to trick law enforcement officials.
I thought it was fascinating reading about that because one of the last points they made was, you know, if we close one of these down, then another one's just going to pop up right afterward. And I guess that's kind of inevitable. And I guess it's how it's always been, you know, the evolution of how this stuff is done in the first place. Yeah, I think it's going to be more stuff popping up. Maybe they'll get more prepared, I guess, for people coming after them. But I can't see this necessarily being the end of services like this.
What was taken down were these dark web marketplaces that were operating over Tor. But these are still marketplaces that are operating a lot like eBay, where, you know, it's a central place and people list stuff and then people buy stuff, that it's a two-sided marketplace. And I think what I've seen coming up are things like Open Bazaar. So Open Bazaar works over Tor as well, which is a sort of anonymizing network, but it's a lot more like, you know, a Shopify, where each individual person can run their own store, but it's part of this larger network. And if you take one down, it doesn't take down all the rest. So there's no like central place to take down for these. And it's just lots and lots of different stores and people buying and stuff going up and down. I don't know how you would disrupt all of that, despite, you know, lots of laws and stuff. And there's, you know, people selling frightening things like fentanyl and other animal tranquilizers that can incapacitate a city on these services. It's still happening. I mean, it was happening before the internet. If anything, when you see these, just how much money was pulsing through these systems, even the news reports about them being shut down, I'm sure someone somewhere goes, oh, well, there's a huge market opportunity there. I'm going to go set one up.
Mike, I'm going to agree with you. This show is all over the place now. But if you think about it, you know, back in the analog world, one of my friend's relatives used to be a police officer in Jersey City. And this is going back, you know, 30 years when Jersey City was not so nice. One of their things they do is they get, you know, the old Chevy, and they do like the old crash car. They'd roll up to the street really fast, you know, lock up the brakes, jump out and try and catch whoever was there, you know, dealing drugs. And they did this all the time, but everybody would scatter, you know, and they collected the contraband that they dropped and when they ran off. But the same people were back, you know, in the next corner, the next block. It didn't matter because, as Mike said, there's a ton of money to be made. And if they caught one guy, that's more market share for everybody else.
So what do you think happens now? They roll up and like people scatter and there's just like pieces of paper with QR codes for Bitcoins laying everywhere and their burner phone that's connected to Tor and just laying on the street.
That's it.
That's it. I think we just have our new NBC gritty crime drama on Friday nights after NCIS. So,
I really like what Wells Fargo and IBM's doing. They're creating these jumbotron screens and rooms, sort of like what you see in the movies, and they simulate cyber attacks to prepare for a cyber catastrophe. And they equate what they do to The Last Samurai, the movie with Tom Cruise, where they spend days preparing for potential war. And I feel like whatever happens is never what you anticipate. And you can always imagine the worst case possible. But what if it was just like a really simple attack that creates the catastrophe? I really like the idea of these cyber war rooms just because they look really cool. So I don't know, maybe one of you guys can bring me back down to earth and tell me whether or not this is an actual practical, realistic thing, or we're just trying to be cool like Tom Cruise.
I think
cyber
it is.
Samurais.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I mean, I guess the idea is that basically what they're doing is they're making replicas of their existing IT systems and then effectively doing like emergency training as if something had hit their environment. They're going in there, they're trying to fix the issue in a simulation of what would look just like their own environment. I think while there may be, you know, you can only train against things you know already exist and you can't exactly predict what's going to happen 100%. It's not, you know, going to be guaranteed perfect. I think having some practice in handling that sort of situation is going to be a positive. Just from, you know, a stress inoculation standpoint, you know, if you get hit by something ridiculous and your systems are, you know, going down left and right and you're freaking out, I think having had some experience in even fixing a fake issue or a simulated issue would be a benefit.
I think this is great. You know, one of the things I worked on this week was trying to draw some differences between the WannaCry and the NotPetya ransomware attacks. And one of the things that really came out of it in terms of differences was that lots of IT groups are prepared for a WannaCry type ransomware attack where, you know, one person's infected, you know, a couple folders on the network get encrypted. So they fire up the backup and restore software, restore the files, and they're back in business. And almost nobody has even thought about or practiced something like the NotPetya attack, where, you know, the master boot record for every workstation on your network is taken over. All the workstations are offline. All the servers are offline. And you're almost, you know, starting from bare metal machines to build back up your entire infrastructure. Like, what do you do there? That's obviously a very extreme case, but it's possible. It's not crazy to think that that could happen, or some other, you know, disaster. And, you know, if you browse our sysadmin for a week, you'll find someone who's like, well, I've been awake for 36 hours because we lost power at our data center and we had to move everything to a new one. You know, like that happens. So I think it's great. And the more it's utterly wildly reasonable that this stuff is taking place.
I thought this was really cool too, and I knew both of you guys were going to say that. So I'm going to take the opposite opinion here. I can't get behind this though. This is the you know, the gritty crime drama that Mike just talked about. This is what goes in movies. This is the NORAD scene from, you know, War Games. We have all these people hammering on computers trying to avert this disaster. But if we look at a lot of the incidents, some of these big ones do happen, of course. But a lot of these issues are someone gets phished, the basic controls are not in place, and then someone walks out with a ton of data. And we've seen it in so many of these different instances where it's not these gigantic, flashy, zero-day attacks. It's just the basics. And I think these are great for the reason that Chris mentioned, like stress inoculation and dealing with these type of situations. But I think that everybody gets so focused on what's this next zero-day, what's this bleeding-edge thing that's going to get me, where they forget about, you know, locking the front door.
That's a really good point, Killian. I agree with you. I think if people are going to just go back to the basics and fix whatever they need to fix. Kind of like if everybody recycled, then we would be a lot better off.
There's two parts to this. One part is like the glossy pictures of the cyber range, where, you know, there's these massive TVs that are plastered around with cool looking charts and the globe on it with like arcing connections between stuff. I think that's flashy and not incredibly helpful. I think what is helpful is that as IT groups mature, they're able to have a test system. A lot of IT places don't have a test system that is at least somewhat similar to their real life system, where they can practice all this stuff. And even something as simple as what you said, someone gets phished, they get some data breach, what do they do? That can be, you know, the first thing they try out. But even the ability to then track down what data was taken, what happened, who should be told, who needs contact, just even that much planning would be more than most places have, I feel like. So in summary, Killian's wrong.
I think you agree with me, Mike. I think you kind of made the point that I was trying to make, is that's all kind of basic stuff that you have to hit.
I think we should go out to the cyber range and, you know, shoot some breaches or whatever they do there over the weekend. Just hang out.
Bro out on the cyber range. Got it.
Apparently. So.
Do you have a tool of the week for us, Mike?
Yes. And I have an entertaining and fascinating tool. So this is not something that you're going to download. This is something you're going to need to listen to, and it's from another podcast. So on the Reply All podcast, a tech support scammer made probably the worst mistake they've ever done, which is that they called up the host of this podcast, Alex Goldman, and they tried to get him with a scam. And it was the classic Apple tech support scam that, oh, we're an Apple certified place. And they call and they say, oh, we need remote control to your machine. And he was so fascinated by this. He's like, great, sure, let's do it. And he recorded like everything they said. And it just like every time you think like, oh, a reasonable person would have stopped them here, he just lets them go. And it just keeps going and going and going and going. So it starts there and it just walks through like all the stuff they try to do, how incredibly, this almost goes to what you're saying, Killian, like how incredibly simple this stuff is. Their actual scam is they ask you to pull up the terminal window in OS X, and then they just type in, they make it real small, and then they type in, you have a Trojan virus, and they misspelled the word Trojan, and then they maximized it, and they're like, oh gosh, you're infected. You need to talk to our specialist and pay him $500 to get this taken care of. But they make a lot of money at it. And so it's this whole thing. So it's fascinating. I think it's just underlined so clearly how much more work needs to be done in cybersecurity in general. And it was just really interesting. So it's the Reply All podcast, episode 102, Long Distance. So.
Thanks to Mike Buckby, Chris Kaiser, Killian Engler, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again next week. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.